This is an important week. The meeting begins tonight with Brother Pryor, and I know that you'll be looking forward to that event all through the week. Last Thursday night, 150 young married people met for the young married couple's picnic and had a tremendous turnout for that. This afternoon, we need one or two young ladies who would be willing, or young men, to come by the building and count all of the supplies that have been contributed from Marlton Home. There's quite a truckload, and we'd like to find out what supplies have been brought and what particular kinds have been brought. I'd like one more shot at you before we turn to general admonition to the whole congregation. I'm barking at you. You better turn me down a bit. And I'm going to have to shoot from the hip because we're going to be limited in time this morning. Let me just say that by way of introduction, I'm convinced that we're living in a time that's fraught with problems. I don't know of a time in history when there have been so many problems as we're experiencing today. There is the Near East problem, there's the problem of food shortage, there's the threat of nuclear annihilation, there is the energy crisis, there's pollution and smog, famine, food scarcity, religious division, inflation, recession, unemployment, divorce, drugs, you name it, and we've got it. Now, most of these, you might say, well, we're fairly well removed from all of these. These don't really concern us. Our main problem in Searcy is that Jeff Smith is sidelined with a leg injury, and we're not going to have him as quarterback. And that's really about the only problem we've got, other than the fact that my roommate doesn't use deodorant. Such trivialities as these, and yet they look large, but they're not really problems. And yet so many times we are blind to the problems that really do confront us. But there are some real problems that you and I are going to have to face this year and do something about. You're going to have to answer, and I will too, this question: am I going to be a part of the problem or a part of the answer? Now, each one of us is going to be either a part of the problem or a part of the answer. Some of these problems are these: unfriendliness, isolationism, poor attitudes as far as cooperation, as far as hospitality. There will be problems of cheating. There will be problems of theft. There will be problems of sexual immorality. There will be problems of pornography and related subjects. There are going to be all of these things threatening to blow our year together and blow it apart. Now, we know that these things are all bad. And you can add to this list that I've just given you of genuine, legitimate problems, you can add a lot of other problems. And you're going to have to decide whether you this year are going to be a part of the problem or a part of the answer. Now, it seems that though we know that these things are bad, we find ourselves, unless we're very careful, being a part of the problem rather than a part of the answer. Now, how in the world can it be that a congregation or a host of intelligent people, as we are, who are, at least we believe, committed to Christ, we believe to a degree that's wholesome and healthy, how can it be that we, as a group of people, intelligent, committed to Christ, can know what is right and yet do what is wrong? How can we know the answer and yet be the problem? Well, I think it's illustrated in the book of 1 Samuel, chapter 28. Listen to these few verses. Now, Samuel had died, and all Israel had mourned for him and buried him in Ramah, his own city. And Saul had put the mediums and the wizards out of the land. He had expelled them. The Philistines assembled and came encamped at Shunem. And Saul gathered all Israel, and they encamped at Gilboa. When Saul saw the army of the Philistines, he was afraid, and his heart trembled greatly. And when Saul inquired of the Lord didn't answer him, either by dreams or by Urim or by prophets. Then Saul said to his servants, seek me out a woman who is a medium, that I may go and inquire of her. In other words, call me a witch. Seek me a witch. I want to talk to her. This is one of the most human, down-to-earth problems or incidences recorded in all the Bible. Here this man, king of the Israelites, king of the Jews, recognizing the national threat and problem that witches and wizards and mediums and spiritualists pose to any nation of people, he made a royal edict and said, all witches, all mediums, all spiritualists be gone. Zap, get them out. He issued an edict against them. And yet when it came right down to the pinch, Saul told one of his courtiers, go out and find me a witch. Now, here's an example of what we all do. We find ourselves many times knowing what's right, and yet when it comes down to ourselves being in the crunch, we send out a message, send me a witch. We expel all bad attitudes, we expel all these things, and yet when it comes right down to the pinch, we say, well, this one time, I'll do it. And we become a part of the problem rather than a part of the answer. Now, I don't know where you are today, and I'm not going to have time to explore it to the full, but you're going to have to settle in your mind whether or not you're willing to keep on being a part of the problem or be a part of the answer. I'm not asking you, are you a part of the problem or are you a part of the answer? I know the majority of us, we are a part of the problem. Now, I want to give you some very brief recommendations, three of them, in order that you may escape this temptation of becoming a part of the problem rather than the answer. Number one, quit making yourself an exception. Quit making an exception of yourself. Now, we all do this. We rationalize ourselves because it's us, because we're the ones involved, we rationalize ourselves. That's what Saul did. Saul knew what was wrong. He expelled these witches, and yet when it came down to the pinch, when he was in the crunch of the thing, he says, send me for me a witch and bring her to me, or take me to one and let me talk to her. He made this exception of himself. He rationalized, and I don't know what all he thought, but I know what you and I think, and I think I know what he thought. Number one, he thought, this is an emergency. This is an emergency. He looked out there and saw the Philistines out there like grasshoppers. And he said, wow, this is an emergency. Secondly, he went to the Lord and the Lord didn't answer him. And he simply said, well, in this case, since I have tried kind of to do what's right and the Lord didn't answer me on my terms, then I'm going to go on in this emergency and do what I have to do. Now, how many times do we act in the same way? You know what cheating is and how bad it is, and you know you ought not to have any part of it. But in case of an emergency, if there's a ball game and you're up late one night and you don't get to study for the finals or the midterms, some of you are going to be tempted to cheat because it's an emergency. Your mother and father are on your neck. You're going to lose your scholarship if your grade point average isn't kept at a certain point. And in that case, in an emergency, you're going to be tempted to cheat. Are you going to do it? Are you going to become a part of the problem, or are you going to be a part of the solution? You know we've got an energy crisis, and yet when you take your girl to Little Rock, you're going to be found doing 70 or 75 miles an hour. Why? Well, this is kind of an exception. This is us. We're late. And if we don't get to the Casa Bonita in time, there'll be a line out there 6 miles long. And so we set aside the law of 55 miles an hour, and we go ahead and do what we do because, well, I'm king, Saul could have said. I'm the king. I can do what I want to in this land. And he made himself an exception, and we do the same thing. Do you realize that nobody, as an employee, ever stole from an employer but what he thought, I've got this coming, I'm special. I've been working overtime, this old crook doesn't pay me what he ought to anyway, and I really have this coming, and I'm just going to pocket some of these things. This is an exception, this is an emergency, I'm special, and here we go. And brother, we become the problem rather than the answer to it. In Matthew, the 23rd chapter, verses 2 through 4, Jesus says there, do what the leaders say do, but don't do like they do, because they say and they do not. He says, they bind heavy burdens, hard to be borne, and lay them on the shoulders of men, and they wouldn't touch one of them with their finger. In other words, they expect of other people what they're not willing to do themselves. And how many of us are like that? Especially religious leaders are like that. Especially leaders in general are like that. We expect to do things that we won't allow other people to do. But it's not just leaders who do that. And I say leaders, I'm talking about myself. I'm talking about the teachers. I'm talking about elders, and I'm talking about others who are leaders in the church or in the school or in the community. Sometimes we think we're exempt from the law. And we think that we live above the law. I think Richard Nixon thought that. I think he actually felt that he lived above the law, and that was the big question. Are you going to be required to do the same thing us common peons are supposed to be doing? And Jesus said the religious leaders of his day weren't willing to do what they were binding on other people. But it's not just religious leaders. Read Romans, the 2nd chapter, and you'll find how that's a common problem with all people. He said, you're without excuse, oh man, whoever you are that judges, for you that judges, you're doing the same thing. And then he says, look, if you're going to teach people they ought not to steal, are you stealing? You who say you ought not to commit adultery, are you committing adultery? And he simply poses this same common, everyday, constant problem that all of us get involved in, making exceptions for ourselves and thus becoming a part of the problem rather than a part of the answer. And you're right slap in the middle of it, and so am I. I can see it in my own life at times. But let me give you the flip side of it, and this is the second thing. Let's put it in the positive. Only do that which, if it were made universal, would make the world a better place. You got that now? Let me tell you who said that. Who is he? Immanuel Kant made this statement, so act that you can will the principle of your act to be law universal. So act that you can will the principle of your act to be law universal. Do you know what he's saying? He's saying don't ever do anything that you could not then project to a universal scale and expect it to produce good. We were coming through Israel in 1970. My wife and 3 sons and I came to the area around Magdala, where Mary Magdalene was born and raised, or where she was raised at least. And we came there to an edifice that had been built. And on the floor of this edifice, there was this huge mosaic. And the thing must have been 15 by 15. There wasn't anyone there guarding it. It had begun to crumble around the edges. The little squares of porcelain or however, whatever it's made from, they had begun to come loose from the floor. Man, they would have made the most fantastic souvenirs. And my boys, some of them said, let's get some of these as souvenirs. And man, they were beginning to pocket them. But I was at least smart enough on that occasion to recognize. I said, now wait a minute, boys. Do you realize that if everybody who had come to look at this mosaic had done what you're about to do, that there wouldn't have been any mosaic for you to see? They hadn't ever thought about that. But they thought about it and realized, by the way, if everybody were to do like I was doing or was about to do, there wouldn't be any mosaic. Now that's what I'm talking about. Live so that if you were to make your actions universal, everything would be well. I'm reminded of the story of the guests who were invited to the feast, and the only requirement was that everybody was to bring a jug of wine. All the neighbors in this whole area was to bring, all they had to do was just bring a jug of wine and come to the feast. And they were going to pour all this wine into a big vat. And sure enough, everybody brought that jug of wine. They came smiling, you know, and poured it into this big vat. And then when the feast started and the people went by to draw off their glass of wine, you know what everybody got? Yeah, water. You know why? Because everybody that came to the feast made this rationalization. One jug of water in 200 won't make a bit of difference. And everybody thought it. And everybody acted accordingly. Consequently, what was made for one person was made a universal principle, and everybody ended up drinking water. Now, in Galatians, the 5th chapter, there's a statement made there that we're being offered an opportunity. Galatians 5, listen to this contrast. Now, the works of the flesh are plain. You're familiar with it now. Immorality, impurity, licentiousness, idolatry, sorcery, enmity, strife, jealousy, anger, selfishness, dissension, party spirit, envy, drunkenness, carousing, and the like. What a cruddy bunch of things that could be thrown all together in one mass of corruption. You wouldn't want to live in a place like that. Listen to this other alternative. The fruit of the Spirit is love and joy and peace and patience and kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. Now watch. Life has invited you and me to a feast. It's invited us to a feast. And all that life says to us is, we want you to bring a box or a basket full of love and joy and peace and patience and kindness and goodness and faithfulness and gentleness and self-control. We want you to bring a jug full of that. Let's keep the figure in the same area. He says, we want you to bring a jug full of that. That's what life says to us. And he sends out this invitation to all the people, all of you and me. We want you to bring a jug full of all this. And so here we come into life, and we all bring our jug and pour it into the vat. All of us smiling, you know, and pouring it in there. And then when we draw it out, you know what it produces? We come out with immorality, impurity, licentiousness, idolatry, sorcery, enmity, strife, jealousy, anger, selfishness, dissension, party spirit, envy, drunkenness, carousing, and the like. You know why? Because each one of us, though we know what we ought to do, says, well, it won't really make any difference if just I act like this, so I'll bring my jug full of the works of the flesh and let everybody else bring the fruits of the Spirit. And we end up drinking crud. We end up drinking this mess. We end up having this in our cup rather than what life ought to be filled with. Now, do you see the principle? You understand what I'm talking about? Now, which are you bringing into life? You've been invited. You're here as a guest in life. What are you providing? Are you going to be like the people who all brought water? They are part of the problem. Or are you going to be like the people that really and truly would have brought wine and should have brought it, and we're in that class? We're going to have to choose. Are you going to bring water or are you going to bring wine? Are you going to bring the fruits of the Spirit or are you going to bring the works of the flesh? Don't live in any way but what you could make your life universal, and it would be a profit and a benefit to the world. And then finally, never underestimate the power of a single example for good. You know, we look at the problem, and we think many times, it's so big, what can I do? I'm just one, just me, poor little old me. What is my contribution of good going to do anybody? And I guess I'm as bad at this as any other thing, any other attitude of mine. I think I succumb to this one. Maybe you're not a part of the problem, but you hang suspended in suspended animation, and you don't really get into being a part of the answer. You're just kind of there. And that's not good. I think of Joshua every time I think of the example of one man's powerful influence. In Joshua 24, Joshua said, "You choose whom you will to serve. But for me and my house, we're going to serve the Lord." And the Bible says that the last part of that chapter 24, that all of Israel served the Lord all of the days of Joshua and all the days of those leaders of Israel that outlived Joshua. What a powerful influence that man was for good. Now, that's a lesson for us today. There was an atheist once who spoke at a huge gathering of people, and there seemed to be no one to oppose him. In the middle of his vilifying and of his belittling God and speaking out and blaspheming him, the story goes that one little teenage girl back in the audience, stood up and with tears in her eyes and with a quiver in her voice, began to sing, "Stand Up for Jesus." And all the eyes of the assembly turned and looked at her, but nobody got up. She sang the first verse through, and then she started on the second verse. And someone else then in another part of the house got up and began to sing it with her. And then a third stood, and then a fourth, and then two or three more, and then finally 10 or 15 more, and then whole rows began to stand up, and people began to sing, "Stand Up for Jesus." And finally that whole audience stood up and in one voice sang, "Stand Up for Jesus," and sat that fella down that was the atheist. Now that came from just one single little girl's quivering voice. What a tremendous effect and an example one person can have. And you can make the applications for it. Maybe everybody on the football squad curses. I doubt it. But there's going to be enough on there that curse that what good is your example of clean speech going to do? It'll do a lot. Look at Willie Franklin. He's going to be a good example for us this year. And you can go throughout this whole academy, the school, the college, this church, this whole community, and you can ask one question, what good will I do? I'm just one. And I'll tell you what, you can do a lot of good if you'll not discount the powerful influence of just one single example for good. Are you going to be a part of the answer or a part of the problem? If you'll quit making exceptions of yourself, if you'll start making your life such that if it were made universal, everything would be good. If you'll realize the power of one single influence for good, then you'll start living in such a way that you'll be a part of the answer and not the problem. You're going to have to make your choice. This is the choice that's before us today, and you're going to have to choose. I hope you will. I hope that you'll decide right now, this morning, that you're going to be a part of the answer and not a part of the problem. Wouldn't it be great to live in such a place as that, where everybody was a part of the answer? Those who are a part of the problem are going to spend their lives gnashing their teeth. In the judgment, they're going to be sentenced to hell. Matthew, the 24th chapter, says that those people will be assigned to the place of the hypocrite, where men gnash their teeth and weep, because to know the answer and yet be the problem is hypocrisy at its highest level. And let me say this, you know the answer. There's not a one of you here today that doesn't know the answer. Let us stand.
Every soul of thy sin oppressed, there's mercy.